you're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and coming up, a study into our DNA and how a 14th century pandemic altered our evolution, with its effects still found in our genetics today. But now, it might not feel like it today, but winter weather is on its way to Wisconsin, and so are higher heating bills. Higher natural gas prices are driving up costs this winter, and some of the state's energy companies are seeking to raise their rates starting January 1. Fortunately, many residents in Wisconsin can do more to prepare their homes for winter and increase energy efficiency to keep those heating bills down. And there is financial assistance available across the state to help lower-income residents pay for these winter upgrades. Our guest, Tony Francis, is the Weatherization Program Director for North Central Community Action Program. And Tony, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, and you know, you're in the North Central Community Action Program, but community action agencies across the state have similar weatherization programs to yours. So tell us a little bit about some of the services that you offer.
So our weatherization program, as you said, is a statewide program. We happen to here at North Central provide the services in 8 counties in central North Central Wisconsin. And the services that we provide are things like air sealing, insulating. We also address energy conserving measures such as, say, the aerators on your faucets, your shower heads, light bulbs, refrigerators, freezers, furnaces, water heaters, all energy consuming products you have in your home is something that we look at to see if we can possibly upgrade or replace to make more efficient.
And Tony, why are these programs so important as you see it?
Well, I really enjoy the program because it's, I believe everybody wins with this program. So yes, it's for low-income people in our state, who our clients are and we serve, but these are taxpayers' dollars. And as a taxpayer, it just seems responsible to do the weatherization work rather than spending all the money on trying to pay for the energy. If we can conserve the energy and lower the costs, obviously the homeowners, their bills are less, so they win. But I think overall the taxpayers save money as well.
How much of a difference can weatherization make? And in terms of energy costs for a home, Tony, what's the bottom line?
Yeah, so for a typical average home in Wisconsin, they will save $390 annually after the first year of their weatherization. And when you figure out the materials we put into these homes and the life expectancy of them, they'll save I lost my train of thought here.
That's all right. We were looking at the whole life cycle of the home. But
I was given a number for North Central, but that number is true per home statewide as well. But statewide, say, for example, last year, we weatherized over 4,000 homes in Wisconsin. Mm. And those homes saved $1.5 million in the first year, and they will annually for the life expectancy of those measures. So that equals up to be about $36 million saved in energy.
Well, and just in the individual household, Tony Francis, the headline I saw from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel is some heating costs in Wisconsin could go up $20 to $30 a month this winter. But as you detail the savings from the weatherization program from the community action, it amounts to more than, on average, in ballpark figures, more than $30 a month. So it could help offset some of those increased costs, which leads us to who would be eligible for these resources, Tony.
It's completely eligible income based. So you apply for how our program works is you apply for energy assistance. And that is a two-part program. Part of it helps pay for the energy bills. And then the other part is my program that kicks in and we try and save energy overall.
So how can someone who's listening to you this afternoon tell if their home's in need of weatherization?
If you live in a home, anything probably older than 15 years old, you're probably in need of weatherization. To be honest with you, we help a lot of homes and a lot of different age groups. I would just say the best thing to do is to contact Energy Assistance to see if they qualify. And if they do, we certainly would like to consider to see if we can help them.
Is there anything available for renters or landlords?
Absolutely. So this program that I run is a no-cost program to our customers. and it is for homeowners and renters alike. We help both of them, and the idea of that, if they're, whether they're a homeowner or the renter, they're using energy and spending money. So we want to save energy and save money is what we're up to.
Tony Francis, Weatherization Program Director for the North Central Community Action Program. While all may not be eligible for the weatherization assistance through Community Action, what are some common things that people can do to make their homes more energy efficient for the winter?
Well, most people think they need new windows, and usually that's not the case. However, we do get a lot of heat loss through our windows, so your standard practice of covering your windows with plastic, if possible, that's a big help. Obviously adding insulation, but that can be costly. So your biggest bang for your buck is air sealing. If you can stop the air leakage around your doors, windows, in your attics, your basement, any gaping holes or where you see air movement, that's your number one energy saver right there, is to be able to make your home as airtight as possible.
And finally, Tony, are there some areas of the home that we might be overlooking that we might not think of as being energy inefficient that we can improve upon?
If you have an attached garage, a lot of people don't consider that, but not only is that energy efficient savings available there, but it's also a health and safety thing to make sure that garage, attached garage, is not getting into the home space at all and that they are completely separated.
So, Tony, how do folks apply for this energy assistance and weatherization program?
So you can, throughout the state of Wisconsin, you can contact your county for energy assistance. As far as the eight counties that I serve, Wood, Marathon, Lincoln, Langley, Taylor, Rusk, Price, and Sawyer, they can contact me through on our website. We have our application right on our website at northcentralcap.org.
And we have a link for that on our website at wpr.org/centraltime. And Tony, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Tony Francis, Weatherization Program Director for North Central Community Action Program, with us today sharing details about how to reduce home energy costs this winter and what resources are available for weatherization. Now, it's time for Wisconsin Life, and here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about a Madison business owner and a politician who helped sponsor Cuban refugees housed at Fort McCoy back in 1980. He's also one of the people featured in the new podcast, WPR Reports, Uprooted.
Ricardo Gonzalez came to the United States in the 1960s when his family left Cuba following the revolution. Ricardo eventually settled in Madison, where he served on the Common Council and opened the iconic Cardinal Bar. When 15,000 Cuban refugees ended up at Fort McCoy following the 1980 Mariel boatlift, Ricardo made it his mission to help his fellow Cubans find sponsors in hopes of finding them a better life in the United States. The other voices you'll hear, other than Ricardo, are the hosts of the Uprooted podcast, Maureen McCollum and Omar Granados.
People who sponsor Cuban refugees out of Fort McCoy weren't just limited to southwest Wisconsin, near the military camp. They were also in cities like Milwaukee and Madison.
And one of the people who helped them resettle there was Ricardo Gonzalez. Ricardo fell in love with Madison, where he opened the iconic Cardinal Bar and Rick's Havana Club.
And while the Mariel boatlift was underway, Ricardo was also executive director of the Spanish American organization. He set off to Fort McCoy to help his fellow Cubans find sponsors.
The refugees were housed in these bunkhouses. And when we got there, and I saw all these Cuban, mostly men, just hanging around with nothing, I felt the hurt that so many of my countrymen were in that situation. And I thought, this is not right. What are we going to do about it? Because I knew that I could probably help a handful.
Ricardo realized he had to choose who he wanted to sponsor.
We decided, well, let's see if there's any families. Let's start with families. Mom, dad, and the kids. Second, women.
There weren't many women.
There weren't that many single women, no.
Yeah.
And so I thought, let's concentrate on gay people. A lot of people were thrown in jail in Cuba for being homosexual. That, to us, was not a criminal offense. So we chosen, picked along those lines.
Ricardo found sponsors around Madison for the refugees, though he says most of them left Wisconsin pretty quickly.
But then there was a group of people who ended up staying in Wisconsin for a bit. When Ricardo was making those regular visits to Fort McCoy, he caught wind that a group of musicians had formed a band. Since he owned dance clubs and loved music, this gave him an idea.
And I thought, well, let's get that group to come to Madison. We loaned them some instruments and they played some kind of a benefit show. Then they had to go back to Fort McCoy, and that's when I decided to get them organized as a group, as a band, and sponsor them as a group. And that's what we did.
Wow.
We sponsored all 12 of them. I got them an apartment over on the 500 block of Mifflin, West Mifflin Street. And I remember we went to this church, and the church gave us the money we needed to outfit the band with instruments, brand new instruments, and a brand new sound system. I gave them a speech about how music is the language that breaks down the barriers. It's an international language. You don't have to speak it. You listen to it. You feel it. And that concept is what I thought would help to generate goodwill towards the refugees.
To learn more about Ricardo's life in Cuba and more about the Cuban band he founded in Madison, check out the podcast WPR Reports Uprooted. All 8 episodes plus historical photos are at wpr.org/uprooted. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, our ancestors survived a 14th century pandemic that killed tens of millions, and a new study reveals how that's changed our genetics. Next on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. New research analyzing the DNA of people who died from the bubonic plague and people who survived it finds that the biggest mortality event in human history influenced the way our immune systems evolved. The genes that helped people survive the Black Death nearly 700 years ago are today linked to autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and Crohn's disease. And here to tell us more is one of the authors of the paper, Luis Barrero, professor in the section of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago. Luis, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you analyzed DNA from people who were around like 700 years ago. How does that work?
Yeah, so that was work done in close collaboration with Dr. Hendrik Poynar from McMaster University, who is an expert in ancient DNA. And the way it works, it's simply to be able to access genetic material from human remains. So in this particular case, were human remains buried in 3 London cemeteries. So the DNA was derived from about 300 skeletons. From people that lived either before the Black Death, people that died from the Black Death, and people that lived, a couple of generations afterwards. So, practically speaking, the way it works usually is that we extract DNA from teeth. So we just, break it down the teeth and try to obtain, those ancient DNA materials.
And Lewis, in your research, you found 4 genes that had a big role in determining whether someone survived or died from the plague. Tell us more about these genes and the role they played in surviving or dying the Black Death.
Yes, that's right. So we surveyed, a panel of about 350 genes, and when we start looking at signatures of natural selection that would basically allow us to determine if some genetic variants were protective against the Black Death, we boil it down to 4 particular genes and genetic variants. So these genes are involved in a variety of immune processes. One gene that we studied in further detail, it's a gene called ERAP2. So this is an aminopeptidase. What it does is that once we get infected with, say, a bacteria, like Yersinia pestis, the agent that caused the Black Death, this gene is going to be involved in cutting in small pieces the proteins that are encoded by the bacteria and then allowing our immune cells to present those small pieces at their surface as some sort of an alert system that an infection is going on. So it's a way to call and alert other immune cells that there's an infection, and that will lead to a strong immune response against the pathogen.
So these, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so what we know that it occurs in the general population is that not everyone is able to perform this function. So there's a particular genetic variant in the genome that makes that some individuals have the a functional version of these proteins, of this protein in particular, and other individuals have a non-functional version. So what we see in this paper is that having a functional version of URAP2 was protective during the Black Death.
And so that is what inevitably evolves with the rest of us as we move on from this pandemic of the 14th century. And today, one of the genes that protected people during the bubonic plague is associated with autoimmune disease. Lewis, tell us more about this.
Yeah, so that's right. So that was, you know, somewhat, you know, a surprise, an unexpected result that came out from the study was the realization that this same variant that I was just telling you about, for example, in URAP2, that protected, that we predict to have been protective against Yersinia pestis during the Black Death, it coincides with the same genetic variant that today increases the risk for Crohn's disease, an autoimmune disorder. So we speculate that what happens is that, depending on context, certain genetic variants might be beneficial or detrimental. So in the context, for example, of trying to fight an infectious agent like Yersinia pestis, we probably want to have a very robust and strong immune response against the pathogen to try to kill it. In contrast, in the context of an autoimmune disorder, what happens is that our immune system is responding against our own cells. And in that case, having a strong response is going to be actually detrimental and is going to increase the risk of severe symptoms. So there's some sort of a trade-off between, you know, protection against infectious diseases and increased risk for inflammatory and autoimmune disorders.
Luis Barrero, our guest, professor of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago. So with you studied the Black Death and killed, 50% of Europe's population in less than 5 years, have other plagues throughout history had this kind of impact on our evolution, Luis?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the impact in evolution. We have not studied that specifically, but you know, the Yersinia pestis, the agent that caused the Black Death, was associated with multiple pandemics. So not just the one that is the most known is the Black Death. So that was the second pandemic from Yersinia pestis. But there's other pandemics like the Justinian plague from 541 to 750 was the first pandemic associated with Yersinia pestis, and then more recently in the 18th century there's a third plague pandemic that also killed millions of people. I mean, to be honest, and though most people probably don't realize that Yersinia pestis, the bacteria, it's still circulating, and you know, every year, even in the US, there's still people that die from Yersinia pestis. Of course, the numbers are very small as compared to these large pandemics in the past, but it's not as if the bacteria completely disappeared. In certain areas of the globe, like Brazil, Peru, Madagascar, there's still a fair amount of cases every year that are reported.
Yeah, and when your research into the Black Death, and as I mentioned, it was devastating, killing up to half of Europe's population over a span of just 5 years. Was it the scope or the sheer scale that caused this evolutionary, that influenced the evolution of our immune systems? Or was it how was it that, you know, we've evolved this way as a result of this pandemic?
Yeah, so I think it was definitely the scale of it that allows us to see evolution in such a short time window, right? So when we think about recent evolution and natural selection, we tend to think in the scales of thousands and thousands of years. So here we are talking about evolution in a scale of, you know, a few generations. So the only way that we can see such a signature is if we are in a situation that, you know, a large fraction of the population dies of a particular disease. And not only that there must be genetic variants that increase significant protection against that same disease.
Well, it's impossible not to think of the COVID-19 pandemic and what this may portend. But then I also think of the advent of modern medicine and what vaccines have meant to our safety and survival in the midst of a pandemic. So in your role as a professor in a section of genetic medicine and at the University of Chicago, do you see COVID-19 changing, our genetics?
Yeah, that's a great question that, of course, I get a lot. And for obvious reasons, but it's so I think that it's unlikely that we will see some similar effects as the ones we saw for the Black Death for at least a couple of reasons. Like first, of course, we went through what we went through in the past 3 years was hard for everyone, and a lot of people died, but it remains also the case that mortality rates associated with COVID-19 are, orders of magnitude smaller than what we saw, the 50% mortality rate during the Black Death. So that's a huge difference in terms of a selective pressure. Second, and probably even more importantly, most people that die from COVID-19 tend to be elderly people, so after reproductive age. So from the moment that you already have kids, you already transmitted your genes to the next generation, and therefore, even if you die, that's still not going to be seen by natural selection. So this is not to say that they're not going to have an impact, but it's definitely going to be, for it to have an impact, it will be over many, many, many years if the disease keeps impacting human populations.
Fascinating research. And Luis Barrero, thank you so much for sharing it with us this afternoon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Luis Barrero, professor in the section of genetic medicine and chair of the Committee on Genetics, Genomics, and Systems Biology at the University of Chicago, talking to us about his recent study finding that the Black Death played a part in our immune system's evolution. Join us tomorrow for Central Time as we take you to Wakanda. We're delving into the Marvel Universe with a return of the Black Panther to the big screen and a cultural movement that transcends comic books. That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, though, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then political scientists from Waukesha and La Crosse join us to break down the midterm election results in Wisconsin and across the country. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're listening to Central Time.
Live.
It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, national election results and the latest on the battle for control of the U.S. House and Senate. But first, we have winners in Wisconsin's two big statewide elections. Voters re-elected Democrat Tony Evers to serve his second term as governor, and they chose incumbent Republican Senator Ron Johnson to serve his third term. We're going to get into these and more of the state's election results, including the extremely close down ballot contests, and you can join us at any time at 1-800-642-1234. If you voted at the polls yesterday or worked at the polls, what was your election experience like? Good, bad, otherwise? What do you think about the results we've seen so far? Happy with the outcomes? Unhappy? Is it a mixed bag for you? What about coverage of election last night? What did you watch or listen to, and what did you think? Love to hear your reviews of how you think the news media did. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us anytime, ideas@wpr.org. Joining us, our guest, Lily Gorn, professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on this afternoon.
You bet. And Tim Dale is a political professor, political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. Tim, welcome back to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start with the governor's race. Lily, here's a clip of current and future Governor Tony Evers last night speaking to supporters in Madison after midnight.
I'm Tony Evers, and I'm incredibly proud to be the 46th governor in the state of Wisconsin. Tell you that on January 3rd, 2023, I will still be the 46th governor.
Lily, what was it that stood out to you about the results in this race last night?
Well, again, we've been sort of looking at this across the board in terms of ticket splitting and the fact that Governor Evers got reelected and Ron Johnson got reelected, which is not necessarily what one might expect. And we also had seen this in the past with regard to sort of Walker Obama voters, I believe, and Baldwin Walker supporters in the past. So Wisconsinites are a little, you know, mavericky sometimes.
And Tim Dale, let's bring up the other Tim, Republican challenger Tim Michaels. We know that he called Evers to concede, and it wouldn't normally make a point of saying as such, but we are today. Why is this significant?
Well, it's significant because I think that there were Republicans across the country, as we've heard for 2 years, with deep suspicions about our election systems. And I think one of the things that was tested nationwide was whether that argument was going to be persuasive to win elections. And I think by all accounts, historically, the Republicans did not do as well as we've seen typically in a midterm election in a president's first term in office. And so I would predict that we would see more of that maybe going forward is really a desire to move forward, because I don't know that it's a winning strategy to claim that all elections are bad elections.
Michaels appeared to lose some ground in the traditional Republican wall of the so-called wow counties, which were brought up in the national media last night time and again. That would be Waukesha, Ozaukee, and Washington counties around the suburbs of Milwaukee. And I'd be interested in knowing what both of you think of this, but I'll start with you, Lily. You teach in Waukesha at Carroll College. What about the GOP support of the wow counties and whether or not we're seeing a shift there?
Well, again, in the past, Ron Johnson had sort of relied on the wow counties as the sort of foundation of his election campaign. And the expectation, if one's going to win as a Republican in Wisconsin, you do have to run up the vote there. And there is definitely a difference in terms of the vote numbers that Johnson got there versus Michaels. And I said this 6 years ago that, you know, Johnson ran ahead of Trump in Wisconsin. And I think you see this again with regard to Johnson having run ahead of Michaels in Wisconsin, but particularly in the wow counties.
Yeah. And Tim Dale, what do you think of the wow counties and the Republican support there and whether or not it's eroding?
Yeah. And I think that elections like this, it's sometimes difficult if we're looking at overall trends or just something that happened in this particular election. And Lily might have more to say about this in terms of what she's seeing on the front lines. But I really think that at least the exit polls that I'm seeing are showing that abortion was an issue on a lot of people's minds, particularly in state races. And I think if we did have split ticket voters, there is going to be some reason why people were comfortable voting for Ron Johnson for the Senate and Evers for governor. And I think that the counties around Milwaukee may be the kinds of places where you have people willing to split their ticket when a big issue comes up like this. I think overall, an explanation for why we saw what we saw, even though Wisconsin voters are notoriously willing to split their ticket.
Can I just add something to
Yeah.
that? I did want to add this in terms of the discussion of, you know, not only the split ticket voting, but also in terms of the appeal of Ron Johnson, who, again, was running for a third term in the Senate, fairly well known, particularly among Republicans in the state, and Tim Michaels, who was less well known, who had a very contentious primary fight with Rebecca Clayfish, who is also very well known among Republicans in the state, as well as Wisconsinites in general. And I have a feeling that that may have been part of the issue with regard to Michaels's loss. Not as well known, perhaps not as well liked as Ron Johnson or even Rebecca Clayfish in the primary.
Lily Gorin, our guest, professor of political science at Carroll University. Also, Tim Dale joining us, professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. And we invite you to our conversation as well as we review the results from last night's election here in Wisconsin. Join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And the AP didn't declare for Senator Johnson until around midday today. Here's some of Senator Johnson speaking to supporters last night.
You know, I do believe that this time truth has prevailed over the lies, over the character assassination. But I will say, unfortunately, it's still so close. And that's a little depressing, isn't it? That lies can be that effective.
What about this general election between Senator Johnson and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes and the character assassination, as Senator Johnson called it? Tim Dale, what did you see as this campaign rolled through Wisconsin?
Well, I think that we're kind of used to negative campaigning. So I guess I wouldn't call this particular race any more or less negative than what we see in other races. It got very heated. The candidates had a lot of things to say about the other. And I think that I was not surprised by what we saw. The other thing that was happening, and I think we saw this dynamic in both races, is that in both the governor and the Senate race, we saw the incumbent win. And there is a clear incumbency advantage, even if it's only a couple of points. And I think Lily put it before that voters know the candidate who is in office. And so what Ron Johnson is responding to there obviously was attacks, but I don't think we should be surprised when we see attacks in a political campaign. And certainly Johnson was responsible for those as well.
Yeah. And Senator Johnson said again on the Dan O'Donnell show on WISN AM this morning that he was surprised that the vote was as close as it was with Mandela Barnes. So Lily, what's behind the power or the strength of the incumbency for candidates in Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, in Wisconsin and nationally, there's a lot of literature, political science literature, on the strength of incumbency, because, in fact, voters are familiar with you. And they to some degree, know you as a candidate, as an elected office holder. And I think you saw that in both Ron Johnson's case and in Tony Evers' case, is that they didn't necessarily redefine themselves. They sort of, you know, to some degree spoke to how voters understood them to be, whereas Mandela Barnes, who had in fact won statewide race as lieutenant governor, which is perhaps a less visible and maybe important job in a lot of ways, perhaps. I don't want to undercut it, but they didn't know him as well. And the same thing with regard to Tim Michaels, who had run statewide in Wisconsin before, but not successfully. And so both of those challenger candidates had to define themselves, and voters had to evaluate whether they found them attractive, likable. And sometimes, you know, I'm not sort of saying this about any candidate in particular, but voters often think sometimes the devil you know versus the devil you don't know.
Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. Also joining us, Tim Dale, professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. We have calls coming in, and we'll get to them momentarily at 1-800-642-1234, but there is room for your reaction as well. What do you think of the results last night in Wisconsin and the split-ticket voting of re-electing both Democratic Governor Tony Evers to his second term and Republican Senator Ron Johnson to his third term? We'll get your reaction and our guests when we continue on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret. And right now we're picking up the conversation looking at the results of Wisconsin's midterm elections. Our guests are Lily Gorin, political science professor from Carroll University, and Tim Dale, professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. We're going to you now at 1-800-642-1234, getting your reactions from the results last night and inviting you to join our conversation and ask our experts your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to Pat in Three Lakes. Pat, you're on the air with Lily Gorin and Tim Dale.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for taking my call. On the Senate race in Wisconsin, one of the guests said that Johnson was likable or was well-liked. I'm an independent. I vote split ticket. Johnson's not well-liked by too many people. If Alex Lazary would have run, Johnson would have been beat by 10 points.
Why do you think that is, Pat?
And, one of the reasons is because Alex Lazary is married with a family and a businessman. The people in rural, and that's where we're at, the people in the rural areas of Wisconsin would have voted for him over Johnson, even the Republicans. I know a lot of Republicans. And we were looking for somebody besides Johnson. And Mandela Barnes didn't have the timber. We just, you know, not that he couldn't have eventually, but he didn't have it. And I honestly think that we were looking for a businessman, a family man, somebody that had been successful in the private part, in the private industry. And I think, and I know, just by talking to a lot of people, some diehard Republicans, they would have won 100% for Lazary because they really don't like Johnson that much.
Why didn't
why didn't they go for
Mandela Barnes?
I don't think they didn't think he had the president or the senatorial timber.
Do you see race playing a role in this, Pat?
Oh, I think it did in some areas and in some situations, some parts of the state. I'm sure it did. I think it played a fairly big role. You know, it's got to the point where black people can get elected if they really have it. They have to have a little bit more than I think than their white counterpart. But Mandela could be that person because he seems to be a nice person. He doesn't have it now.
Pat, I very much appreciate the perspective from Three Lakes. I want to get some more perspective in before we go back to our guest. Let's go to John in Appleton. John, good afternoon. You're on Central Time.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks to everybody for all you do. Are we for sure on the results of the Johnson-Barnes race? I mean, what we're relying on now is just the AP calling. When will the official results come out, and could they be different? And I'll give you my thoughts about Mandela if you want them later.
Well, let's go to our guest first. Lily, are these results finalized? Is this the way we're going to end up when every ballot's counted?
Well, I mean, again, we are seeing in some of the down ballot races that there may be a call for a recount. I don't know that I've heard anything. Obviously, Mandela Barnes conceded to Ron Johnson earlier today, I believe it was. And so I don't see him pursuing a recount, but I haven't heard definitively.
Tim Dale, let me ask you about Pat's question about Lieutenant Governor Barnes not having the timber in certain parts of Wisconsin to be a U.S. senator. And, you know, the contention in that campaign. NPR had questions about Barnes' opposition to cash bail, the priorities of crime in the state of Wisconsin. How many of these facets played into the outcome, especially in rural parts of Wisconsin?
Yeah, and I think that those are really good questions. The elections are usually more complex than just a single issue or a single set of concerns from the voters. One of the things I think the caller mentioned was in terms of whether or not someone else might have been successful in the race. Another factor I want to point out that hasn't been mentioned yet is that in both cases, we have voters doing something that's fairly typical, which is voting for divided government. In voting for Ron Johnson, we have Biden in the presidency. Voters are sending to Washington a Republican, which is something that we typically see with a opposition party in power. In the state, it's the opposite. We have a Republican legislature and a vote for Evers. And so I think that there are dynamics beyond even the candidates that we see. And I'm not sure that another Democrat may have fared differently when you have essentially a Republican candidate running in a race where people say, I would like to see a Republican in Washington, I'd like to see a Democrat in the state.
There's also, bringing up the issue of split-ticket voting in Wisconsin, Governor Evers' margin of victory exceeded that of Attorney General and incumbent Democrat Josh Call, who narrowly defeated Republican challenger Eric Toney, and it exceeds the Secretary of State with incumbent Democrat Doug La Follette, leading at this point in the narrowest of margins, Republican challenger Amy Loudenbeck. And then we have a new state treasurer. Republican John Lieber will be replacing Sarah Godlewski, who was running for in the primary for that Senate seat, and he narrowly defeats Democrat Aaron Richardson for treasurer. So as you look at those down ticket races, Lily Gorin, what do you see there?
I mean, I think that Tim's point about the kind of splitting up with regard to the divisions of power, not only in the executive branch, but also in the legislature, where Wisconsinites did not give the Republicans a veto-proof majority in the legislature. So what we do have is we'll probably have a continuation of gridlock. And this is interesting compared to some of our neighboring states where there was a sort of an accumulation towards one party in Minnesota and in Michigan, if I'm looking at the data correctly. And so Wisconsin will remain in this kind of divided government situation.
In the U.S. House, we saw a flip in the 3rd District, which was held by Democrat Ron Kind for decades. He has stepped aside and retired. Republican Derek Van Orden defeated Democrat Brad Pfaff, and that is the only really contentious House election that we had yesterday in all 8 House seats across the state of Wisconsin. So what do we make of these outcomes across the board, Tim Dale?
Yeah, well, I'm sitting over here in the 3rd Congressional District, so I had a front row seat for that race. So much money poured in from outside of Wisconsin to that race. And actually, Pfaff was a little disappointed that some money was pulled at the last minute. But I think that we saw that race kind of on the front lines of the effort to take back the House and then to build up some advantage. With Ron Kind stepping down, it certainly was an open seat. And Van Orden was well-known in the district, had run before. Pfaff as the challenger certainly put up a good fight, but we had an open seat. And as often happens, and I think the seat probably is going to go down in the column of a win for whatever slight wave there was. This is a district that probably would normally be voting Democrat, where the way the district lines have been drawn. And so what we saw was a lot of money pouring in, knowing that this was the kind of seat that Republicans could pick up. And it definitely was contentious, as you said.
Yeah, so you'd expect potentially even more money in just a few more years, because as I look down the list here in the second congressional district, Mark Pocan was reelected by more than 40%. In Milwaukee area, Gwen Moore was reelected by more than 50%. Scott Fitzgerald was reelected to his second term by about 30 percentage points. And Glenn Grothman was uncontested. Tom Tiffany was reelected by more than 20%. Mike Gallagher was reelected by more than 50%. So does this leave us with only one contested congressional district as we look towards 2024, Lily?
I would say so. I mean, the districts in Wisconsin have been drawn fairly safely. And to some degree, they are also representative of potentially an imbalance in terms of representation of voices in Wisconsin, given the sort of 50-50 nature of our election outcomes, but the skew with regard to how many seats are held by Republicans and how many by Democrats.
Lily Gorin, I wanted to ask you about some late-breaking legal challenges, in particular a Waukesha Circuit Court hearing over handling of military ballots and some concerns about whether ballots would be counted or whether the election was secure. What did you see there?
I mean, I saw the information about the lawsuit, and then I saw also that it was, you know, it was stayed so that it didn't come to fruition. But again, you've seen a lot of these challenges with regard to voters in particular ways that they vote, be they military voters or people who are voting by mail, and challenges to whether or not these mechanisms for voting are legitimate, which seems to be the case more often than not coming from Republican challenges, but not exclusively.
Tim Dale, what other takeaways do you have from yesterday's Wisconsin midterms?
Well, I think basically what we've been talking about, that I think people are voting for divided government, and they're essentially saying that they're not particularly happy with either party right now. And I think that we also see kind of a lack of a national narrative from either party. And so what we're going to be watching, I think, going forward is what kind of arguments emerge and what kind of cohesion we might see in terms of solution oriented discussions. So I'm looking forward to the next couple of years to see how this might shape what we're already going to be talking about probably within the next week, which is election 2024.
Yes, we've already talked about
it. Never stop.
Tim Dale, Lily Gorin, thank you both so much for joining us this afternoon.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Lily Gorin is professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Tim, sorry to cut you off. Tim Dale, professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. And that cut you off because I want to let you know we're continuing our conversation about the election outcomes from yesterday, and we're expanding our focus beyond the state of Wisconsin, but still taking a look at its impact in our state to the national election results, election security, and questions about the election and what it portends for the future of our country and our own backyard. Would also be interested to hearing from you. Sorry we didn't get to all those calls that half hour, but there is more to come on the outcome of yesterday's elections and what that means for us going forward. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.